Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. Hi, Sam. I'm delighted to have you back on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. For our listeners, they might recall that you were one of my earliest guests when we launched this thing 2 years ago. And I do believe that our conversation, which actually was quite a provocative conversation, we were talking about sort of the flawed characteristics in some of our contemporary fundraising practices, still probably one of the hottest downloaded podcasts. Anybody who goes on and searches the podcast would find that our conversation was quite provocative. So we'll make sure to put some notes. We'll put a link to that particular episode in the show notes. But Sam, before we get started, would you mind just introducing yourself?
Yeah, hi, my name's Sam Butler. I'm the head of public fundraising at Starlight Children's Foundation. And it's really lovely to be back on your podcast, Jason. Thank you for inviting me.
Sam, you and I agreed that we were going to talk about some of the big headlines that are sort of making the news in the charity sector, or at least getting the attention of the charity sector in the United Kingdom and possibly elsewhere. Why don't you tee up our conversation with one of those, and we'll kind of follow that outline today.
I think the one that we talked about sort of before today was the article from Ian McQuillan on the kind of the begrudging attitude that some fundraising voices give in response to hearing that somebody's done something incredibly philanthropic and how damaging that can be to the sector as a whole. I'd be more than happy to kind of start there. And then there's two other articles that kind of hit the press this week. We've had an amazing kind of fundraising effort that's received a lot of media attention over here by an ex-veteran who's just turned 100, called Captain Tom. And obviously in the lead up to VE Day and with a lot of the rhetoric that's been surrounding how we're under attack from COVID, there's a military sort of tone and theme in a lot of the political rhetoric that's been used over here. He's raised just over £130 million for the NHS, which is incredible. But there's obviously backlash to that again from the community in terms of the fact that the NHS is meant to be a state run organization, and that the Chancellor of the Exchequer quite openly came out at the beginning of this stating that whatever the NHS needed in regard to funding, they would receive from the Exchequer. And then the last article is more around kind of the impact that this is not only having in terms of the Black and minority ethnic groups in both the UK and in the US, has been reported. But also that it's also having an impact on the funding of causes that are there for those groups as well. So it'd be good to kind of talk around those sort of three subjects.
I think Ian put it very well in the headline, that in his particular article, this notion that we in the charity sector, we in the sort of philanthropic networks like to maybe implicitly and sometimes explicitly like to think that we can police philanthropic or charitable behavior. And I appreciated what he had to say. He suggested that he preferred to be I think you used the word libertarian a little more, you know, the notion that we need to probably stand off, back off, and let philanthropy play out as it so wishes, as it so desires, and not try to perhaps regulate it. I suppose that that's somewhere where the thinking is on your part as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's fine to have an opinion. I think it's when that opinion is kind of is fueled by jealousy or meanness. You know, the right-wing press, I think, is, you know, the article in The Sun attacking Just Giving, which is a sort of platform in which people can set up fundraising events and is vital in terms of what we're doing at the moment with our community fundraising all shifting to a kind of a digital platform. But there's a meanness in what the Sun article is sort of saying in terms of attacking a company that supports charities and has supported charities raise millions and millions of pounds. And there's certainly no way that Captain Tom would have been able to deal with the kind of avalanche and outpouring of goodwill from the British public to raise £130 million if it hadn't been for that platform. So it's a mean choice to try and decry that platform. And I'm certain the Sun newspaper wasn't offering any charities free advertising space in its newspapers over the last 12 months. So, you know, equally they're there to profiteer from our campaigns when we want to advertise them in their newspapers. So there's a level of hypocrisy about it as well.
So I haven't seen the article. So the article in with regards to this article in particular, you're saying that the criticism is directed at Just Giving, at the platform, for presumably and they do they're being accused of profiteering off of this enormous number of transactions. So perhaps if it was so it's not necessarily the fact that the money is going to it's more the profiteering off of the transactions than it is where the money's necessarily going.
Yeah, I mean, the press generally in the UK, I would say, start to have a kind of an anti-charity agency relationship kind of narrative that plays out from sort of June through to August, September. So I think just in terms of the fact that there probably isn't much news out there other than COVID-related news, their charity narrative segment for this quarter has just been bumped forward a month. It usually happens in conjunction with the beginning of July when we have the Institute of Fundraising convention every year. So there'll always be a kind of a big, you know, when the Olive Cook news story broke, which I think is actually what we spoke about at length in the last podcast we did together.
Yeah.
That was around that kind of time of year. And it's usually attacking agencies, whether they're face-to-face agencies, telephone fundraising agencies. It's identifying the fact that somebody is profiting, or a company is profiting off the back of people's goodwill to donate to charities. And so that's the kind of angle that is always taken in the press. And it's Just Giving's turn to be the agency that's under attack today. So yeah, I think this broke today.
Right. And so the criticism, okay, so I'm piecing this together. So the criticism towards Just Giving is really no different than the criticism that would have historically been leveled at direct response, direct mail companies who, you know, basically administrate the process of mail going back and forth between charities and their donors. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're looking at, I think £42 million has been raised on the site for the NHS for this particular appeal. And it's taken an administrative fee of £385,000, I think, to pay for administering those donations. So, you know, if you look at that as an ROI, I think most businesses would be pretty happy if it cost them £385,000 to raise £42 million. But I do think that one of the other aspects of this kind of narrative that's playing out at the moment in terms of the amount of individuals and groups and organizations that are raising money specifically for the NHS is that it's almost like a double tax, because we pay our taxes to fund the NHS because it's a national health service. And there are a lot of other causes out there that are experiencing hardship in terms of their funding models having dried up or disappeared overnight due to lockdown, or large percentages of their funding having dried up. And I think that, you know, there's transparency issues on both sides. There's transparency issues on big causes. You know, I think any charity that's been reliant on charity shops and selling goods through those, and then is trying to initiate a sort of a COVID-related theme, would be far better just to be transparent and say to the public, we raise X amount of money through you shopping in our shops, and we've lost that for the last 8-9 weeks, and can you help us sort of sustain ourselves through those times? But instead you're getting kind of quite heavily brand-led fundraising campaigns to try and steer it to a relevance of COVID-19. And I think for some causes, that relevance is absolutely there. And so that transparency and authenticity of the ask shines through and people will support it. In other situations, the public are sort of having their doubts and going, well, I don't quite see how what you're saying is relevant. I could understand that if you were saying we've had to close down all our charity shops and we need your help and support to keep us going, I'd get that. But how you're trying to align your cause with COVID-19 isn't quite ringing true. So I think, you know, we are in this stage of the relevance of really understanding that your messaging has to be completely transparent and authentic to cut through at the moment.
What part of the criticism is that that's a tax-funded entity and that perhaps they shouldn't be raising funds philanthropically.
I think they're allowed to raise funds philanthropically. I think it's the volume of fundraising that's being identified. So it's that, you know, I don't know what the percentages are, but certainly in terms of the media coverage of fundraising activities that are supporting the NHS directly, there's a huge amount of media coverage for that. And so that's what most people are seeing on their television screens, and that's why most people are donating to it. And it's an incredibly worthy thing to be donating to. But I think the voices of reason are saying there are also other causes out there that are vitally important right now. So domestic violence, for example, has risen incredibly significantly during lockdown as people are forced to stay in the homes with those that actually might be perpetrating that violence upon them. And, you know, I think in terms of my own personal awareness around issues that I would now choose to donate to that maybe I hadn't before, that's one that's really resonated with me. Because, you know, I've been incredible. One of the things that I am incredibly grateful for is that during this lockdown, I am in lockdown with my family, and we are coming through it well. You know, well, I've got a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old, so two surly teenagers trapped in their homes.
We've got four of those. So.
Right. Wow.
So, Sam, it reminds me. It totally. So we have a local here in my community. We have a local pretzel shop. So a small pretzel shop that has been in business for about the last. I bet the business has not been around for more than about 5 years. Yeah. And this little pretzel shop is a business that, you know, my family has become fond of. It's down in our little downtown that's been trying to sort of revitalize itself. And at one point, I don't know about. You know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, maybe it was a little longer, right after all of this sort of started to play out, I noticed that there was some sort of a campaign. There was some sort of what appeared to be a fundraising campaign to ensure the pretzel shops. You know, this is a commercial enterprise, and we didn't participate, but we would not. It's not that we chose not to participate because we just didn't. There was really no judgment on my part. But what occurred to me when I saw that was similar to what I think the press is talking about here, what we're talking about here. And it's this idea that sometimes we want to, like Ian said in that article, we want to sort of police who can benefit from someone else's, you know, quite honestly, just human behavior, their generosity. I mean, somebody, you know, if somebody wants to so be generous to my local pretzel shop in order to keep it open, they have every in a free society, they have every right to do that.
But there's a blurring of the lines in terms of what you're then doing as an organization that is purely charitable. And right. So if you're blurring those lines, it's very difficult for fundraisers to market what it is you do that is purely charitable. And so there's another kind of area that fundraisers are battling now, far more kind of apparently, which is, what does your charity do that is purely charitable? So, you know, one of the reasons I decided to work directly for Starlight Children's Foundation was that we provide services for free. So there's no, you know, any hospital or hospice in the country that wants our services, we provide those services for free. There's no cost to either the individual that's administering those services or the beneficiary that's benefiting from them being delivered. And to me, that just makes my job so much easier, because I can tell you exactly what your money's going to do as a supporter. Whereas when I was at St. John Ambulance, you were constantly trying to work out what percentage of what you did for free was therefore funded by those supporters that supported it. So if you're a volunteer at St. John Ambulance, undoubtedly you're going to spend a lot of your time in your community supporting your community with free first aid cover. But you're also going to be asked to go and fulfill very large contracts that St. John Ambulance has with very large organisations. So one of the biggest would be the Football Association. So every Saturday or Sunday when you go to watch a football match, the volunteers that you see at those games are doing that for free. But the service that the organisation is benefiting from being delivered is a contracted service. And so therefore, St. John Ambulance is being paid to deliver that via the FA. So it just makes it really grey. And I think what people want in moments like this is absolute clarity. They you know, the more black and white things can be, the better.
So I'm looking at this article in The Sun, this David Jones character is suggesting that Just Giving should give back the money that they charged.
Which is a narrative that's played out several times.
It makes me wonder if Just Giving, you know, you were speaking a few moments ago about marketing. It kind of makes me wonder if companies like Just Giving are just going to get smart. The reality is that if Just Giving stops, and we've got a number of these platforms, if they stop charging fees, they couldn't exist. And then the volume of gifts that we're talking about wouldn't happen. And so it makes me wonder if a company like Just Giving would have, I don't know what their fees are, but let's say, for example, they marketed themselves as having a 4% fee, and that they donate 2% of their fee, you know, the narrative changes.
I think it's really difficult for a platform like Just Giving to have a kind of a blanket rule, because I think, you know, undoubtedly where a campaign is incredibly successful, that's probably being more, you know, it's undoubtedly being more cost effective for Just Giving. And where where I raise £1,000 and I've got, you know, 100 people that have contributed to raising that £1,000 is probably not being that cost effective for them in administering my 100 donors and those donations and all the gift aid that needs to go through. And I'm sure they're very savvy and they've got lots of automated systems in place to make sure that they can be as kind of quick and light in administration as they possibly can be. But, you know, they didn't know when Captain Tom set up his Just Giving page that he was going to go on to raise £130 million, you know, and what you were 40 odd million through their actual kind of platform and link with it. So I think you just have to, you know, as a business model, you just say, well, there's a cap. And if a campaign raises over X amount of money, we stop taking our administrative fees. But, you know, you can't sort of, I don't think you can plan as a company like Just Giving to deal with a situation like Captain Tom, because it's remarkable that a 100-year-old man doing 100 laps of his garden with a walking frame has gone on.
I don't know who Captain Tom is. I'm sure everyone in the United Kingdom does, but I'm looking at this photograph of this gentleman. I'm thinking, why is it that the press has to nosy themselves into a situation like this and take away the joy of this older gentleman having accomplished what he essentially has by coming up with this idea? And I think that in some ways is the obligation that we have in philanthropy as well, is to not diminish the joy. And this, again, this gets back to Ian's article. Yeah. Are we policing philanthropy in such a way? And I think this played out with the way that the response to the fires in Australia, this played out in response to the Notre Dame fire. Yeah. We're taking away the joy. Those of us who want to offer criticism to who gets the money and how they get it and where they get it are taking away the joy of those who are giving it.
Yeah.
It would seem to me like these people are going to start fleeing. The very people who are doing the criticism need people to give.
Yeah.
And it seems like we need to kind of back off of our high post and maybe carefully think about how it is we offer some of this criticism, or ultimately the donors are going to go away.
Yeah. And I think there's a part of it that's about absolving yourself from and, you know, it's very easy to point a finger and go, well, that's unfair, or that person should have been paying their taxes in the first place, or our taxes should have been higher than they actually are in the first place, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a kind of that rhetoric is about absolving yourself of responsibility to make things better. And I think what Ian was saying, you know, I'm not a historian like Ian, but I would imagine in terms of a period of time where we saw great philanthropy in our country, we're probably talking throughout the kind of Victorian era. And that, you know, that was pre the welfare state, the setting up of the NHS after the Second World War. And I think, you know, we are now a nation that has a government who we put a lot of pressure on to deliver what would have typically been delivered by charities. So, you know, the likes of Dickens, Swift, J.M. Barrie, there were kind of celebrated individuals that did a huge amount of kind of philanthropic good. Dr. Bernardo, St. John Ambulance was set up sort of just around the kind of Industrial Revolution period. And so all these big names in the charitable world were set up and initiated through great philanthropic individuals or groups. And I think what we've kind of done a little bit recently is to moan and whinge about J.K. Rowling, a great author of world renown, who's decided to donate £1 million to a charity, and then getting lots of kind of negative press about, well, that's not very much for someone that's a billionaire, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, that's a lot of money. Let's celebrate it. And actually, if we celebrate it, maybe more people like J.K. Rowling will come out of the woodwork and want to kind of do good things. And, you know, I am a cajoler, so I'm a big Springsteen fan. I think some of my favorite moments in life have been spent at concerts just basking in how this guy and his band have walked out on stage and for 3.5 hours just made me feel incredibly joyous as he's sung to me about all the wrongs of the world. You know, if you actually listen to the lyrics, they're often about losers, people being downtrodden, things being unfair, governments being liars and scoundrels, et cetera. But he does it in a way that makes me feel joyous and elated. And I walk out of there feeling like I could take on the world and all its ills and do something positive about it. And to me, that's what fundraisers should be doing. Exactly the same thing. And it's that whole, you know, it's, I guess, Maya Angelou summed it up where she just said, you know, people won't remember what you said or what you did. They'll remember how you made them feel. If you're choosing to be critical of people and pushing people away, you're never going to be as strong a position as you would be if you were offering people an opportunity to learn, develop, and showing some level of understanding if people don't understand what it is you do or don't understand why it is you've got an issue with the way they do something.
So this brings us back to the accusation in my first book, and certainly the conversation you and I had when we were on the podcast the first time. What is it about these and you said it, you used the word here a moment ago, the idea that we sort of distance ourselves. We deliberately maintain this distance between those who do the funding and those who give the fund, you know, the giver and the receiver, if you will, which makes for this combative misunderstanding that often plays out in any number of ways, and then point fingers at each other. I mean, what is it about the charity sector that causes us to maintain that distance? I don't know that it's jealousy, but sometimes when I've had moments where I was working with a client and I saw them cringe at the possibility of buying lunch for an individual who had far more wealth than they did, and I thought, you know, what forbids me the privilege of buying somebody lunch? I mean, I enjoy buying somebody lunch every once in a while, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you just summed it up in terms of, you know, the inherited processes and policies that are probably far too old and aren't relevant anymore. I think we've in my lifetime, I am a migrant to the changes we've seen in technology. I am not a native. And I'm an entrepreneurial networking fundraising kind of person. That's my main thought and how things should constantly be changing and evolving. And in order for me to, I guess, kind of be aware of how they could possibly change and evolve, I try and keep tabs on both the kind of the principles of fundraising that have been inherited from the likes of Ken Burnett, Giles Pegram. I was at a brilliant conference just before Christmas that was a regional Institute of Fundraising conference, where a woman called Eileen Hammond, who had been a fundraising leader at the end of the 70s, early 80s, gave a plenary talk about fundraising in a power cut and the fact that when she was a fundraiser, emails, mobile phones, text messages, WhatsApps, Facebook, TikTok, all these things didn't exist. You went and spoke to people. And I think you've always got to have that overriding sense of being human, and humans like to give to other human beings because they feel they're part of the solution and they're solving a problem, which I think is what Ian was saying so eloquently in his article this week. But on the flip side of that, I think you've got this perpetuated school of fundraising thought that is often not taking into consideration the changes we're seeing in society. So you've got the 12 principles of legacy fundraising, or the 12 principles of corporate fundraising, and you've got to take people through this. But actually, the vast majority of people want to just sort of know how they can help you and the easiest way they can help you, how they can feed up. So you've got
the donor doesn't know any of
it at the moment, where you've got the old guard and those principles, but you've got the new guard and these toys. And it's like, how do you put those principles and those toys together? So, you know, I know that you've spoken and met with Nikki Bell. We actually were really fortunate in that we had a training session with Nikki set up for 2 weeks ago, which we ended up delivering online for the first time, and it went brilliantly. But to me, she understands that. She gets the fact that you can bring those principles and the toys together, and you can provide your team and your organization with a way of modernizing their fundraising practices, and that they will be beneficial for everybody involved, for the professionals involved in using them, for the beneficiaries that benefit from more money being raised, and for the supporters that feel that you're relevant and that you can talk to them on their terms, on their choice of platform. So yes, of course, there's still going to be those individuals that want to sit down in your funding groups and circles and lunch with you and talk to you face to face. But there's also a huge army of people that are completely native now to just wanting to do everything online. And that's how they want to. That's how they want to engage with you, and how they want to support you. And actually, it's not that black and white. You know, when I think about my own parents now, they're probably giving more to charities through Facebook, or you know, email or online platforms than they have ever done before. So they've kind of been on this migration as the baby boomer generation. They've migrated to giving in a very different way to the way in which they would have done traditionally.
And do And here's a question. Do we is your parents' tendency to give more and give more online in any way connected to what they see and observe you doing in the work that you're doing?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, my brother-in-law works in the charity sector as well. My mum worked as an occupational therapist, which is sort of an extension of the National Health Service. Yeah, my dad sits on my dad is a trustee of a small charity down in Devon. So I think that they're very aware of causes. And I guess, like anything, you tend, you know, in a community sense, you're giving to the person, you know, your connection with that charity or cause and why you want to support them isn't necessarily that the cause resonates with you. It's that your relationship with that person really resonates with you.
I don't want your dad. So, for example, if your dad, I don't want to in any way diminish the family tradition that is evidently a family tradition. What I want to do is I want to find a way to be transparent with him, to use your word. You've repeated that word a number of times. I don't know why we can't be gracious and sit down with your father, for example, and say, hey, perhaps you could do it this way. But it doesn't necessitate me publicly, putting that charity or his name in the press and shaming him for perhaps something that he doesn't even really understand himself to the fullest extent.
And I think that I think that's another thing. So, many charities will have these sort of segmented groups of individuals on their supporter base where they, well, we've always communicated with them via direct mail. So that's how we'll communicate with them. Well, have you ever asked them for their email address? No. Well, so how do you know that, and have you educated them in the cost of communicating with them in that way? And, you know, there's lots of kind of groups of people educating fundraisers in how to kind of, if you don't use direct mail and you use email, or you use TikTok, which is now the kind of the growing trend, or Tiltify, but it's all relevant to the audience you're talking to. And that, there will undoubtedly be lots of people out there that just say, well, I want to receive that mail from you. And if it costs you an extra £3 to send that to me rather than an email, or an extra 30p, then I'll donate that extra 30p on top to cover your costs. And it's the speed at which, I still get a bank statement every year in paper form from my bank. And at the bottom of it tells me, you could be receiving this via email. And every time I receive it, I think, right, I must just get in touch with them and say I'm happy to receive it by email. And then 12 months later, I get the letter through the post again saying exactly the same thing. So, I think you can sometimes read too much into the behavior of people, whereas what would be a really sensible thing to do is just to sit down and just say, do you like getting that pack from us? Or would you be happy to get it from us via email? And until we ask that question with that individual, you're never going to know.
Until you initiate that conversation, you're never going to learn that, in fact, on their end, this policy or procedure, this practice that they've gotten, this habit that they've gotten into, may be far more frustrating on their end than it ever was on yours.
Yeah.
But you've never had the decency to pick up the phone and ask, hey, could we change this? That to me seems like the most important thing in all of this is ultimately we're trying to get to trust. So we're trying to get to the point where we trust both the person who's doing the funding and then the person who's getting funding to do what they say they're going to do. Yeah. And it seems to me like some of these campaigns, be it in the press or be it on social media, are not going to necessarily instill the type of trust that we want the average donor to sort of pick up on.
Yeah, and I think also that there is a big change in the way that money is now sitting with an individual. I think it was in the Times Rich List about 2 years ago where 75% of the Sunday Times Rich List had gone from being inherited wealth to sort of individuals who'd become self-made billionaires through entrepreneurial activities, usually connected to tech companies. So you've got a very different group of people sitting with the most wealth in the world from those that you've usually had. So, that's not to say that inherited wealth is still incredibly valuable and those family foundations and trusts that have been set up to support specific causes are still incredibly and significantly vital to the sustained, existence of many charities. But there's also a group of people out there now with huge amounts of wealth that want to engage with you in an entirely different way. And I don't think that we've necessarily mastered how that's done. You know, maybe there is a kind of a philanthropic major donor fundraiser sitting out there raising all their funds purely through messaging billionaires on Twitter. I don't know. But I think that there are signs that there are charities out there, you know, like child.org, Charity Water, that are significantly changing the way in which that traditional model has worked. And I think there's a self-sustained paralysis that might actually be the undoing of some of those really big organizations over the next 10, 15 years. And, you know, it may be sped up by what we're going through at the moment in terms of COVID. Because if you don't adapt and change, like nature has taught us all along, you become extinct. And, you know, I think that there's a need for, I mean, the one positive that I hope comes out of this, and I've seen it where I work myself, is that we have rapidly delivered a lot of things that we plan to deliver over the next 3 years very quickly. And it's because we've had to. And I think that that's one positive that I am hearing within the fundraising community. I mean, there's lots of other things, and, you know, like Ian hinted, entire fundraising teams having been furloughed under the job retention scheme the government set up. And, you know, it's not for me to criticize what other CEOs and charities have chosen to do, because they have chosen to do those things with the insight I don't have to hand. And, you know, they may be sitting on reserves that will see them through. They may have pipeline of income coming in through trusts, through legacies that they know will keep them going through this. But I do think that the one positive we can all take out of this is that fundraising needed to be done differently before we entered this COVID-19 lockdown. A lot of charities have started to do things quite differently as a result of it. And we need to sort of learn from what we've tried and tested through this period as to what worked, what didn't, and come out and start doing more of that. I think this kind of paralysis of not wanting to do anything through a fear of upsetting somebody is just, it's going down a wormhole that's going to lead you to extinction. But to actually trial and test things properly, see whether they work or not, why didn't they work, adapt that thing if it's worth adapting and try it again. That's, you know, there's some great thinkers out there. Leslie Pinder at the British Red Cross, who's head of the supporter experience there, has been doing some brilliant stuff. You know, so there are, it's kind of like, are you going to sit on the fence and say that there's some bad stuff and some good stuff? Are you going to sit on the other side of the fence and just say there's only bad stuff happening? Or are you going to sit on the other side of the fence and say there's only good stuff happening? You know, there's all things happening. And, you know, I think that the community has got so much better at sharing insights and wanting to work together. It just needs to be happening right at the very top. There needs to be a better understanding of exactly what is working from the CEO down. And I've been fortunate to have always worked with CEOs that have taken a great interest in fundraising and what's working. But I know that there's lots of people out there that have battled to try and gain that level of insight at the top. So
I think fundraisers are very naturally change makers, and we want to bring about change. But I think we also want to ensure, to sort of bring this conversation to a close, I think we want to ensure, I think what you and I are sort of gelling here is the notion that in that historical narrative of how change occurs, it's probably advantageous for us to be on the right side of history. I don't want to, when the change that we're trying to bring about actually happens, do I want to be that person who is known for having named and shamed someone, or put their name, you know, very publicly in the press, for example? Or do I want to be known for that person who sat down with that same person and very carefully and patiently walked them through a process that, you know, led to a much more trust building sort of process?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it actually, one of the biggest and most significant things that can happen in terms of leadership is that the diversity of leaders can change. And, you know, that was one of the aspects we probably don't have time to properly go into today. But the kind of the charity so white movement, in terms of the fact that there is a real lack of diversity at the top of a lot of the charitable organizations in the UK. I haven't got any insight into what's happening in the US. But that, you know, that really does change the way in which people think and organizations think, because they're made up of people. And one of the most diverse organizations I ever worked in, certainly in terms of leadership as well, was the agency that I worked for at for 10 years, which was a mass acquisition face-to-face fundraising agency. Yeah. The diversity of the staff from the top down was really significant. And I enjoyed it more than, you know, in terms of the collaborative elements and what I was able to learn from other people. It was really significant. And I think that's something that, you know, all charities would benefit from massively. So yeah, I mean, maybe the next time, if we do this every 2 years, maybe the next theme could be
2 years.
Yeah, sort of the diversity and ethnicity of the charity sector. Because there's a lot of rhetoric coming out of the press over here now about, you know, how actually it's those groups of people that are experiencing the worst impact as a result of COVID-19 too. So
we will not wait. Sam, I can assure you we need not wait 2 years to have you back on here again. You're welcome. You're welcome. You've become a friend and you're welcome anytime. Sam, if anybody's listening to us today and they're intrigued by some of the comments or remarks or ideas that you've shared, how would you suggest that they reach out to you?
I'm on LinkedIn. I'm under Samuel Butler, but I'm known as Sam. So sometimes people don't find me that easily. But yeah, Samuel Butler on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter as CharitySamDM is my handle. And yeah, feel free to get in touch with me through those two channels for sure.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.